this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, "He Doesn't Suffer Fools Gladly." If you thought starting, building, and selling two multi-billion dollar businesses is enough for Fred Eshelman, you thought wrong. And that's the headline on the front cover. And then inside, the article has a second headline. Far from done, founder of PPD, Eshelman charts his new ventures with same vigor, resolve. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. Many Triangle executives play golf, or go to Hurricanes and Panthers games, or even get as crazy as deep sea fishing. Boring, yawns Fred Eshelman. I like to hunt mountain lion, he says. No, he's not joking. He's even caught one. The trick there is, you can become the hunted if they get behind you and you don't know where they are. His voice trails off as he purses his lips, shrugs one shoulder, and raises his eyebrows. There's a little element of, this could go wrong. In pharmaceutical circles, Eshelman is best known for founding PPD, the Wilmington-based contract research organization that helps drug companies develop and test experimental new drugs. After a stint on Wall Street, PPD was taken private in a $3.9 billion deal in 2011. Eshelman owned 7.8% of PPD, according to a public filing made earlier that year, which would put his stake in the deal worth north of $300 million. While at PPD, Eshelman spun out Furiex, a company developing a treatment for IBS, or irritable bowel syndrome. Furiex was acquired in a deal that could reach $1.46 billion. Eshelman personally could make $350 million in that deal. To most 67-year-olds, this would seem like a good time to hang it all up and walk away from it all. After all, he already owns a ranch in Wyoming, a house and boat in Grand Cayman, and a private jet to get back and forth at his leisure. But then again, most people don't hunt mountain lions. He founded Eshelman Ventures and has already invested in more than a dozen companies, many in North Carolina. He is chairman of the board of the Medicines Company, sits on the UNC Chapel Hill Eshelman School of Pharmacy Board of Visitors and the UNC Eshelman Institute for Innovation. He has given nine figures to UNC, his alma mater, and recently agreed to join the board of embattled pharma giant Valiant Pharmaceuticals. My wife says, "Why do you have to go to work at 6 o'clock in the morning?" I say, "Because I've been doing it since I was 14. I don't know how to do anything else. And I enjoy it, and hopefully it will keep the income rolling to some degree. What's the alternative? I'm not a golfer, and I've observed that a lot of people who went 1,000 miles an hour their whole career, and then they stop, and they go play golf or whatever, they are dead in 6 months from a heart attack. I don't want to go there, so keep the adrenaline running." He says that last part with a chuckle, but his eyes give a look that indicate he's half serious at the same time. "I've worked my whole life. Don't know anything else to do," he says. "Look, the stuff I do is still interesting. I'm still learning. And in fact, half the stuff I'm involved in, it didn't exist when I was in school. So, as a result, I have to do a hell of a lot of reading and talking to people just to keep up and make a lucid comment about whatever I'm dealing with." After enough prodding, he allows that with the addition of his responsibilities at Valiant, he has gotten busier than he intended. "Truth be told, this got away from me a little bit," he says. "I didn't want to be quite this busy, so I would like to step down the intensity." No small talk. Those who will meet with Eshelman in the coming days and weeks better come on time and come prepared. "He doesn't suffer fools well, because he understands the business and the market," says Art Pappas, now with the Durham venture capital group Pappas Ventures, who also worked with Eshelman at GlaxoSmithKline during the early 1990s. "He studied before a meeting just like he expected you to study before a meeting." Those who serve on corporate boards on which Eshelman is the chairman had better not think that they will come in town just for a nice dinner and sleep through a meeting. To me, there is nothing more infuriating than to have people sitting around supposedly in charge of steering the assets of a company, and they have no idea what the hell they're talking about. That's not to say he rules with an iron fist. I've always set the tone that there should be a free and frank exchange of views, he says. That means sometimes people go toe-to-toe on issues. And he's prepared to put his money where his mouth is. He remembers a time when he disagreed with a chief financial officer who recommended the company raise more money either through a secondary public offering or a convertible note. Eshelman argued he did not want to dilute existing shareholders, a value he held strongly. To resolve the issue, he personally loaned the company money at rates he said were below market value. An incidental start. After finishing school and discarding academia as a career, Eshelman founded what would become PPD as a one-man consulting outfit in Maryland before moving to Wilmington to get away from the D.C. traffic. Looking back, he says he never really intended to grow PPD as large as it became, 15,000 employees in 50 countries. In some ways, the pharmaceutical research industry found him. Dennis Gillings, a contemporary of Eshelman who founded Quintiles, one of PPD's largest competitors, founded the company explicitly to run outsourced clinical trials. When some of Eshelman's former colleagues still in the pharmaceutical industry came to him to also run clinical trials, it wasn't really in the wheelhouse of what he had planned to do. I said, "There is nobody here but me and the dog. I can't do that." And they said, "Well, get staffed up and get ready because we want you to do that." In the CRO industry's infancy, Eshelman says he could get as much as 25% of a contract paid up front, which would give the company enough working capital. To this day, he remains proud that PPD did not raise venture capital money and largely stayed debt-free even as it grew into a corporation with a market cap in the billions. Clash of the Titans. Eshelman says he never really shook the culture of being a small business owner. In a small business, one of the things you worry about is making payroll, so you always have to worry about cash, he says. That held true until the day I sold the company. Quintiles might have grown revenue faster, but PPD always had more cash on the balance sheet. Outsourcing clinical trials, the process of running a large-scale trial to test an investigational new drug in humans, is now more than a $25 billion industry. In the late 1980s, though, it was just starting. As the industry grew, so did the stature of both Eshelman and Gillings, and the two were seen by many as fierce rivals. Eshelman donated $20 million to UNC in 2003, and Gillings gave $50 million in 2007. Two schools at the university are named after each man. In 2015, Eshelman committed $100 million to UNC. Eshelman owns a Dassault Falcon 2000 LX. Gillings owns a Gulfstream G550. Both jets cost in excess of $20 million each. In the end, the rivalry not only propelled them to lead the growth of the outsourced R&D industry as a whole, PPD and Quintiles expanded into these multi-billion dollar enterprises that today collectively employ more than 50,000 workers across the globe. North Carolina is the birthplace of the CRO industry. PPD and Quintiles are responsible for making the state the epicenter of this industry, says Doug Edgerton, president and CEO of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. Always hunting. Throughout his career, Eshelman would spend a lot of time in the air. Flying to and from different business meetings while passing over the Rockies, he would look down and dream of a cattle ranch. So, about a decade ago, he told himself, "I've got to get on with this. I'm going to wake up dead one day and it'll be too late." As has become a theme in his life, Eshelman didn't plan small. He's not a gambler and says he hates going to Las Vegas, but if he were a gambling man, he'd be the one surrounded by a big group at the craps table. He now owns 75,000 acres in Wyoming with a ranch that runs 13,000 head of cattle. "When I drive onto that ranch, it's like a transformation. I can feel my blood pressure go down. I start relaxing. The scenery is incredibly beautiful." Of course, he likes the hunting aspect as well. "I'm a hunter, and we've got every kind of big animal you can dream of," he says. Looking for the next home run. While with PPD and Furyx sold, Eshelman turned the page on the next chapter in his life. He has long been an aggressive supporter of UNC and in 2015 committed $100 million to the university that launched the Eshelman Institute for Innovation to fund innovative life sciences projects. Separately, he launched a venture group called Eshelman Ventures, which has already invested in area companies like G1 Therapeutics, Innocrine Pharmaceuticals, Biotherapy Incorporated, and others. An argument could be made that no other single person has impacted the North Carolina pharmaceutical industry more than Fred Eshelman. Fred has made many remarkable contributions to our industry, including founding PPD as a one-person consulting firm in 1985, said David Simmons, PPD's chairman and CEO. Over time, Fred led PPD's growth to the status of a global CRO, culminating in the sale of the company to private investors who've extended his legacy. There also might be no one else who puts a higher value on the potential successes of life sciences companies in the Triangle. I don't know that I would change anything per se, but I sure would keep on betting on it, Eshelman concludes. And along with this article, there's a box called Closer Look, a look inside the Eshelman Venture Portfolio. Sapience Therapeutics, location Scarsdale, New York. Asepticis, location New Orleans. The Medicines Company, Parsippany, New Jersey. Carbon 3D, Redwood City, California. Cellective Biotherapy, Research Triangle Park. Innocrine, Durham. Neoantigenics, Charlottesville, Virginia. Dignify Therapeutics, Research Triangle Park. G1 Therapeutics, Research Triangle Park. Avind Therapeutics, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Inovia, Tampa, Florida. MediKids, New York. Merix, Chapel Hill. And Flight for Life, Waukesha, Wisconsin. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. First headline, Taylor's Digs. It's been probably 40 years since Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter James Taylor visited the Chapel Hill home where he spent most of his youth. But the apartment that was added for Taylor and his four siblings to practice their music is still there, and his JT initials are still carved in a part of the woodwork. The current owners of the modernist-style house that Taylor's parents built in 1952 on Morgan Creek Road are hoping that notoriety might now help them find a new buyer for the property that inspired such songs as Copperline and Carolina in My Mind, Carolina on My Mind. The Taylors sold the 4,000-square-foot house in 1974 to Jim and Pat Johnston, and now the Johnston heirs are partnering with North Carolina Modernist Homes to open the now-empty house for a one-day public tour on June 4. George Smart, executive director of NC Modernist Homes, says they sold 150 of the 500 tickets in the first 2 days. The Taylor House and surrounding 23 acres is expected to be sold at auction on June 29. Our role is to get more people to see the house and hopefully find someone who wants to buy the property without tearing it down, Smart says. North Carolina Symphony tunes its message to aid music education. The North Carolina Symphony hosted its third annual Friends of Note luncheon on May 11 to promote music education in North Carolina. The event, which was held at the pavilions at the Angus Barn, has a primary purpose to bring musical education to students across the state. Organizers say a majority of North Carolina's public schools lack arts funding, and fundraisers like this help bridge the gap by performing free concerts for children across the state. The symphony conducts 40 free performances for children annually, reaching 55,000 children in that time. The Friends of Note luncheon featured a special performance by 4th and 5th grade school children from the Orange Charter School. Bonjour, Compaign calls Raleigh Group. Business, it seems, won't be the only sector using the newly debuted Raleigh to Paris flight. The Raleigh Ringers, a Raleigh-based handbell ensemble, is scheduled to take the direct flight June 1. The original invitation, according to group spokeswoman Angie Chiatello, came from the American Church in Paris, which requested that the Ringers take part in a celebration of their music director's 40-year anniversary. And it's since snowballed into additional performances in Raleigh's sister city, Compiègne, France, as well as shows in London and Red Hill in the UK. The group, founded in 1990, is bringing 18 people, as well as its extensive collection of instruments and equipment across the Atlantic, and the direct flight is a big benefit, Chiatello says. Rex Open adds money to foundation's cause. The weather on final round day of May 15 cooperated for organizers of the Rex Hospital Open. Funds raised this year will benefit the new North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital, an 8-story, 114-bed tower under construction at UNC Rex Healthcare's main Raleigh campus. The philanthropic arm of Rex has been tasked with raising $10 million to help supplement the $235 million hospital, and fundraisers say they have crossed the halfway mark. Since its inception, the Rex Hospital Open has raised more than $9 million, which has funded various healthcare programs in and around Raleigh. As for the golfers, the total purse for the Web.com Tour event was $650,000, with the winning $117,000 prize going to 23-year-old Trey Mullinax, who won with a score of 14 under par for the tournament. The annoying truth about remodeling. Recently, Biz asked a few residential remodelers to let us in on what it's like to be in their shoes, and what we heard in response was too good not to share. When asked for the best advice they'd give to potential customers, Joe Bass, CEO of My Guys Remodeling in Apex, warns of Johnny-on-the-spot remodelers. The great companies are pretty busy this time of year, he says. If someone can jump on the job tomorrow, this should be a red flag. There's a reason they're not busy. Biz also wondered about some of the more interesting finds that remodelers have found while in the demolition phase of a project. Dempsey Hodges, owner of Dempsey Hodges Construction in Raleigh, offered up this gem. While excavating for a master suite addition on a project in Beaufort, North Carolina, we unearthed medicine bottles from the 19th century that a local historian confirmed were used by the women to treat anxiety while their husbands were at sea. Some things never change. Kiwanis funds Parks Kids Playground. Give money or work hard, that was the choice given to some 240 members of the Kiwanis Club of Raleigh, as the group was prepping to celebrate the 100-year anniversary of the Raleigh chapter. And these members did not disappoint, Biz was told. They raised $370,000 plus for its Centennial Parks project, and as part of the project, about $100,000 was allocated to the city's Laurel Hills Park. Then, on May 14, more than 90 Kiwanians showed up at 8 a.m. to start working at the park. The Raleigh chapter is the largest Kiwanis club in the Carolinas and the fifth largest in the world. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, new plant-based restaurant from Charlotte to expand with locations in Triangle Market. The owner-operators of the Luna's Living Kitchen Restaurant and Juice Bar in Charlotte, now rebranded as Living Kitchen, haven't even finished construction of their first new Triangle location in downtown Raleigh, and already they're making plans for a second shop in Chapel Hill. Living Kitchen, led by founder Juliana Luna and president Stephen Edwards, has signed a lease contract for a 4,035-square-foot anchor restaurant position in the new Village Plaza retail and apartment building underway at 201 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. The new building project is next to the Whole Foods-anchored Village Plaza Retail Center. Living Kitchen specializes in the production of cold-pressed juices, as well as a restaurant focused on vegetarian and plant-based dishes. The 6-story Village Plaza building is projected to start opening in phases in the summer and will include 265 rental apartments, about 15,000 square feet of ground floor retail, and a parking deck. The new restaurant location at downtown Raleigh's Charter Square building is expected to open in July. Raleigh architect Lewis Cherry is designing plans for both new spaces in the Triangle. Transforming Greenville's Concert Hall. Raleigh real estate developer Holton Wilkerson of Community Smith has been negotiating to buy the old White's Theater building on 5th Street in downtown Greenville and is bringing some familiar names from the Raleigh live music circuit to transform the building into a new live concert venue. Wilkerson confirms that Mark Thompson and Pat Dickinson, owners of the Lincoln Theater in downtown Raleigh and the Ultimate Entertainment Event Management and Booking Agency, wanted to take over the historic Greenville building and start bringing in a lineup of shows featuring local, regional, and national acts traveling throughout the state. The group has been working with Greenville city leaders for several months on a deal to buy and fully renovate the historic theater building that's not far from the campus of East Carolina University. The city has been trying for a while to figure out how to use this building. It's a project we're all pretty excited about, Wilkerson says. The White's Theater building, built in 1914, about a half block east of what is now Greenville City Hall, has been mostly vacant since 1999. The 10,000-square-foot building will have capacity for about 600 people after the renovation is complete, a project that Wilkerson estimates will cost about $2 million. Community Smith, Thompson, and Dickinson will be buying the property from the city for $20,000 as part of a public-private partnership. If all goes well with permitting with the city, construction could begin as early as November or December. Lee Chase bolsters local heft with lend-lease buy. The executives of global construction conglomerate Lend-Lease Group have decided to exit the Triangle construction market, as well as in upstate New York, and have reached an agreement to sell the two local office operations to a New York competitor, LeChase Construction. The expanded office will be under the leadership of Jack Goodrich, leader of the company's Southeast region, along with co-leader Seth London coming over from Lend-Lease. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. LeChase Construction Services, which ranked at number 18 among the largest construction firms in the Triangle last year, employed about 35 people and had about $36 million in gross billings in North Carolina. Lend-Lease, formerly known as Bovis Lend-Lease, had about 70 employees in Durham in 2014 and $179 million in gross billings, ranking it among the three largest commercial construction companies in the Triangle. And finally, we have a section called Home Sales, Triangle Area Home Sales. Home sales in the Triangle jumped 13% year over year in April, and median home prices jumped 7%, but the inventory supply of homes available for potential buyers remains stubbornly low. The total inventory of homes in the Triangle dropped 18% in April to fewer than 8,500 units, or about a 2.9-month supply based on average market demand. The market was even tighter in Wake and Durham counties. Each has a 2.1-month supply of homes. Wilmington area home sales. Home buyers in the Wilmington coastal market are showing growing confidence in the region's home buying market as unit sales increased nearly 20% year over year in April. Growth in home prices in the Wilmington market, however, is still not increasing quite as rapidly as in other urban areas of North Carolina. The average home sale price in Wilmington in April dropped 4% compared to the year prior to $238,723. The median sales price increased 4% to $210,000. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Raleigh Orthopedic vies for new Carey Surgery Center. A Raleigh doctors group has filed a request with state regulators to open a new surgery center in Cary. Raleigh Orthopedic proposes a $9.5 million budget for the project and would open the new center in early 2018 if approved. These surgery centers have become a point of contention between hospital systems and independent practices. North Carolina tightly regulates healthcare services, including outpatient surgery centers. And private practices say the regulations and the process effectively edge them out. Raleigh Orthopedics' proposed surgery center would require approval from state regulators in the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. The group proposes to develop an ambulatory surgery center in Cary with one operating room and two procedure rooms. Raleigh Orthopedic would move one of its four operating rooms from Raleigh Orthopedic Surgery Center. The surgery center it operates in a joint venture with UNC Rex Healthcare off Edwards Mill Road, just around the corner from Rex Hospital. In 2015, Raleigh Orthopedic generated $20 million in net revenue and $9 million in net income from the four operating rooms and four procedure rooms at the facility off Edwards Mill Road. The practice expects those figures to increase to $29 million of net revenue and $12.4 million of net income by 2020. Of that total, Raleigh Ortho estimates that slightly less than a quarter of revenue and income will come from the West Cary location. Nothing would change in the joint venture between Raleigh Orthopedic and UNC Rex Healthcare, and the Cary location would still be considered part of the same practice. UNC Health agrees to manage Lenore Memorial's operations. UNC Healthcare has reached a management agreement with Lenore Memorial Hospital in Kinston. Per the agreement, employees will continue to be employees of Lenore Memorial Hospital, and the hospital board will continue to be the governing board. UNC will not own any of the Lenore Memorial assets, but will manage operations. It is similar to relationships it has with Wayne Memorial Hospital, Nash Healthcare, and Pardee Hospital. The health system has other kinds of affiliation agreements as well, including outright ownership like UNC Rex Healthcare in Raleigh. In fiscal years 2013 and 2014, the most recent information publicly available, Lenore Memorial posted net losses of a combined $3.8 million. In the fiscal year ended September 30, 2014, the hospital recorded $123 million of service revenue. Lenore Memorial is licensed for 261 beds and has a medical staff of more than 100 physicians. Local healthcare groups fight for new MRI machine. Three Triangle Health groups will compete to add a new MRI machine. The proposals include Duke University Health System proposes a $5.9 million project to add an MRI scanner at Duke Radiology Holly Springs. Wake Radiology Services and Wake Radiology Diagnostic Imaging propose a $1.7 million project at Wake Radiology Wake Forest MRI office. And Raleigh Radiology proposes a $2.9 million project to add an MRI scanner at Raleigh Radiology Cary. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "We are at an inflection point. A number of things are falling into place." And that's from Ward Peterson, president and CEO of Symbarex, which is in the early stages of developing a drug that could be used in combination with cancer-fighting drugs to reduce side effects, specifically in the lower digestive tract. The company received a patent, became a portfolio company of Blackstone Entrepreneurs Network, and added P.K. Wagner, the former founder and CEO of Icagen, to its board of directors. And finally, in a section called By the Numbers, $2.4 billion. 2016 to 2017 school year budget approved by the Duke University Board of Trustees, a 7% increase from this year. The budget includes the School of Medicine and the School of Nursing, but excludes Duke Hospital and other clinical components of the Duke University Health System. $20 million? Investment that Braeburn Pharmaceuticals will proceed with despite opposition to HB2. Braeburn will add 52 jobs in a new manufacturing and research facility in Durham County. And $90 million. Initial public offering postponed by Durham drug developer Vernet Pharmaceuticals. Analysts had predicted the company would go public by the middle of May, but have pulled the company from the IPO calendar. And now we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, MaxPoint Interactive. Across the pond, Europe provides boost to firms' finances. MaxPoint has increasingly had Europe in its crosshairs, its execs having identified international business as a strategic priority over the past several months. And in its earnings, announced May 17, execs stressed the region's growing importance to the bottom line. The company announced in February that it was expanding its digital zip technology in France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. The technology helps retailers track what people are buying down to the neighborhood. The firm has mapped 30,000 neighborhoods in continental Europe. With that expansion came pan-European campaigns to both United States and European advertisers wanting to target those neighborhoods, CEO Joe Epperson said during the earnings call. And the UK, where MaxPoint opened an office last year, is an increasing revenue chunk. While the company didn't provide a breakdown, Epperson told analysts that UK revenue grew 112% over the previous year. We are excited to see our value proposition resonate in the UK, he said May 16. The dynamic combination of offline and online data is allowing our UK clients to reach their key audiences and drive offline actions. In total, MaxPoint reported $19.4 million in revenue when excluding traffic acquisition costs. Suit settled against Raleigh's Kings over barcade name. A Raleigh bar has reached a confidential settlement with a Brooklyn arcade-themed bar that had sued over its use of the word barcade. New York bar chain Barcade Incorporated sued Kings and its owners in federal court in February, accusing the downtown Raleigh venue of trademark cybersquatting. On May 13, Kings co-owner Ben Barwick said the companies had come to a mutually agreeable settlement, putting an end to the litigation. Kings had not been using the term barcade actively for many years, so it was really more of a legacy thing for us since the word did appear in our website address and in some social media, Barwick said. We are glad to put it behind us and get back to our regularly scheduled programming. Barcade had asserted in February court papers that it had held the trademark on the term since 2008, and it's had a history of going after other venues attempting to use the term, such as Baxter Barcade in Chapel Hill, now listed as just Baxter Bar and Arcade, in its registration with the state. Barcade Incorporated had said in court filings that it feared King's usage of the term could cause confusion, causing great harm to plaintiffs' reputation and goodwill. Burns Tower Co. executes another big sale. Just 4 years after selling assets to SBA Communications for $1.45 billion, Cary-based Tower Co. is selling again. This time, Tower Co. is selling 253 towers and 95 other assets to Grain Infrastructure II LP of Sarasota, Florida, for $244 million. It's the third tower portfolio sold by the company since 2004. CEO Richard Byrne says it's becoming a pattern, pointing out that the company's first portfolio from 2004 sold in 2008, so it's every 4 years, he says. He made the connection with Grain through different people in the industry, and he's already started another version of Tower Co., Tower Co. 4. That firm started in 2015. Maybe we'll have news in 2019, he joked. Tower Co.'s equity investors have included Tailwind Capital Partners and Soros Fund Management, both of whom have signed on with Tower Co. 4. And in a section called He Said It, we're getting behind the train now. And that's from Mark Easley, angel investor and crowdfunding activist on why North Carolina needs to pass crowdfunding legislation in 2016. And in a section called By the Numbers, travelers leave change at security checkpoints. Travelers rushing through airport security checkpoints are leaving behind thousands of dollars. Numbers released by the Transportation Security Administration show that more than $765,000, primarily in the form of loose change, was discovered at airports across the country during the last fiscal year. $5,079.37 left behind at Charlotte Douglas International Airport, and $4,069.95 left behind at RDU International Airport. And finally on this page, there's a section called New Service. RDU Paris route starts with fanfare. On May 12, Raleigh-Durham International Airport's first flight to Paris debuted, with execs from across the triangle coming directly to the gate to celebrate. Our goal is to be the number one global carrier for the triangle region, and so bringing in this transatlantic flight to Raleigh-Durham is another step in the direction for us to achieve that goal. That quote is from Victoria Forbes Roberts, Vice President of Pricing and Revenue Management at Delta, on why the carrier targeted RDU for the flight. I think tonight I'm going to sleep well. That's from Michael Landguth, RDU Airport Authority CEO, on how it feels to finally secure the flight after more than a year of lobbying. The only time I've left the continent, if you will, is I went to Hawaii in 1985, but that was for a meteorological conference. That's from Greg Fischel, 35-year veteran meteorologist at WRAL and one of the passengers on the inaugural flight. It gives French companies great connectivity. And that's from Chris Chung, CEO of North Carolina Economic Development Partnership. And now we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. We'll start with his column with the headline, Clear Mission to Serve Immigrants. In 2002, during his psychiatry residency at the School of Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, Luke Smith saw a gap in services to low-income Latino patients, both in the emergency room at UNC hospitals and at the Carrboro Community Health Center, where he volunteered on Monday nights. Many of the patients were recent immigrants who were confused and frightened, facing the stress of jobs and a new culture, and with psychiatric problems they were not comfortable talking about that showed themselves in physical symptoms, he says. Yet at the clinic and at the emergency room, which patients typically visited as a last resort, he says the people working the front desk did not speak Spanish and so did not accurately communicate to the physicians on duty the underlying nature of the patient's problems. So near the end of his residency, Smith sent an email message to five academic colleagues to spell out the challenges he saw and to suggest ways to better serve patients. A few days later, he received responses from 80 people who had seen his email. Then, after a series of meetings, a group of those people founded El Futuro, a nonprofit that has the mission of advancing bilingual and culturally informed behavioral health treatment for underserved Spanish-speaking individuals and families. Launched in Carrboro, El Futuro now is based in Durham and also runs a clinic in Siler City. It operates with an annual budget of $1.5 million, 27 employees, and 20 volunteers. In 2015, it provided more than 8,900 sessions to nearly 1,500 patients, or just over 6 visits per patient. Immigrants in the U.S. generally are healthier psychologically than the population overall and experience less schizophrenia, depression, or anxiety. Yet, the longer they stay in the U.S., the more the incidence of those conditions among immigrants approaches those of the population overall, says Smith, executive director of El Futuro. Compounding the stress of living in a different culture, he says, are policies and attitudes towards immigrants that are not welcoming or hospitable, and sometimes hostile. And the children of immigrants typically experience rates of mental illness similar to those of the general population, Smith says. El Futuro now is exploring expansion to serve more people in more regions by participating in collaboratives and through integrated care that provides behavioral health services in a primary care setting. El Futuro draws patients from 15 counties but is not easily accessible to them, Smith says. So the nonprofit is also looking for ways to partner with public schools and groups such as Communities in Schools and United Way member agencies to provide strategic interventions that can support these students, Smith says. Providing better psychiatric services to immigrants also can mean a positive return on investment for businesses, he says. Our essence, he says, is to get people back to work and back into school. And now we turn to the nonprofit news. Sepsis awareness on Biomurex's mind. Healthcare diagnostics developer Biomurex held the third annual Step on Sepsis 5K walk and run on May 7, a day that was declared Sepsis Awareness Day by the state of North Carolina. Sepsis is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S., killing more people each year than breast, lung, and prostate cancer combined. UNC Healthcare started a sepsis protocol last year in response to the growing number of septic patients. Bank of America awards $23,000 to support tiny houses. Bank of America announced an award of more than $23,000 to the Durham Technical Community College Foundation for a Habitat for Humanity of Durham Tiny House Initiative. The grant will allow students to be instrumental in the creation of a tiny house for a Durham resident as a partnership with Habitat for Humanity. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, and the first column we read is written by Greg Hsu, who is president of the Americas region of ABB Limited. The ABB group of companies operates in around 100 countries and employs about 135,000 people. ABB's North American headquarters are in Research Triangle Park. And the headline on this Viewpoint column, innovation will rely on new scope of connectivity. Thanks to recent advances in automation and power technologies, it is now possible for a single pilot to fly a plane around the world powered only by solar energy. In the coming years, these technologies will help us run the world sustainably while providing power for all. To attempt a round-the-world flight on solar energy alone, the Solar Impulse Project, which is currently flying across the continental United States, had to solve numerous challenges, both technical and human. The plane had to be able to gather enough energy to take off and ascend to a safe cruising altitude, while also being able to store energy for overnight flights. For long-distance legs of the journey, such as the 5-day Pacific crossing from Japan to Hawaii, the pilot had to be able to get enough rest while remaining alert to dangerous and unpredictable weather conditions. To meet these and other challenges, Solar Impulse engineers drew on the latest electronics, composite materials, and computer-aided designs, as well as technologies enabled by the emerging Internet of Things, services, and people. As the Internet of Things is just a means to an end, the paradigm has shifted to the Internet of Things and services, with ABB increasing its offering of advanced services, including remote monitoring of energy installations and condition-based maintenance for mining and other industrial equipment that helps our customers improve their operations. Today, the next evolutionary development is to the Internet of Things, services, and people, which is happening in industries around the world. ABB's technology is enhancing the role people play in the world of power and automation by giving them powerful new tools to enhance their decision-making, resulting in lower costs and higher profits for our industrial partners and safer, more satisfying jobs for their employees. And we're going to stop there on that article as the rest of it goes into more detail about the company's product and their airplane. We'll now turn to the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who's the editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Oh, the Joy of Finding the Right College for Kids. Lately, I have been making a few trips with my son to colleges across the country. He graduates from high school next year, and now is the time to match the university with his talent and desire. While he looks at amenities, school rankings, prominence, and the overall student life of each school, I inevitably find myself looking at the total cost for a 4-year degree. As told by several economists, successful entrepreneurs, and the 2016 presidential candidates, college costs are out of control. According to the College Board, the average annual tuition fee at a private 4-year institution has nearly doubled in the past 25 years, from $17,000 in 1990 to 91 to about $33,000 in 2015 to 2016. The U.S. Department of Education estimates the collective student loan debt has now surpassed $1.2 trillion. As for public institutions, the College Board estimates that costs have risen 129% in the past 30 years after adjusting for inflation. During the same time, median household income in the U.S. rose just 30%. Simply said, most college graduates are loaded with student loans. For the parents, depending on the number of children preparing for college, the math gets tougher with every passing year. Understandably, the remaining U.S. presidential candidates, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders, have voiced their own iterations of how to tackle this exploding student debt problem should they be elected to the top job later this year. The proposals range from lowering the interest rates on student loans to eat away at the principal, Clinton, to a complete elimination of tuition at public colleges and universities, Sanders. Trump indicated early on that the U.S. government should not be making money off of student loans. During much of the late 1990s and after the turn of the century, the national discussion has been on rising health care costs. People worried about the baby boomers who are now retiring from work and likely will use health care services at a greater rate. The worry remains that the demand for health care is overtaking the supply of services, creating a class of people beyond the non-Medicare and employer-sponsored insured who cannot afford health care. We are right in the middle of that exact scenario, but this time in higher education. The total number of millennials, those born from 1981 to 1997, has mushroomed to almost 76 million, the largest living generation overtaking baby boomers, 1946 to 1964. The last batch of millennials are finishing up, but many before them are now struggling to pay their student loans, rent, and earn wages that can get them ahead. That's the world I now enter with my son leading the way. And now we turn to the People on the Move section, and we'll read the spotlight that is on Tom Ford, Executive Director of the Cardinal at North Hills. The name Tom Ford is most notably recognized on a global scale as an icon in the fashion industry. This Tom Ford, however, is making a name for himself in the Triangle as a leader in the adult care facilities industry. Having been with Carlsbad, California-based Kisco Senior Living for nearly 15 years now, Ford has been tapped as the executive director of one of its newest communities, the Cardinal at North Hills in Raleigh. Previously, he has served as executive director of Kisco's Woodland Terrace facility in Cary and the company's Magnolia Glen property in Raleigh. The Cardinal at North Hills is a continuing care retirement community, which means it will provide independent living, assisted living, and nursing care options. The facility is scheduled to open this fall and is set to house more than 250 residents. The Cardinal is currently 90% pre-leased for its independent apartments, Ford says. The Cardinal will feature living options that include 165 independent living residences and 60 on-site private apartments licensed for assisted living, memory care, and nursing care. When fully operational, the facility will employ nearly 160 full and part-time staffers, Ford says. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? That every day it is a pleasure and honor to make a difference in the lives of our residents and their families. What are some of your major goals for your new position? Obviously, opening later this fall and welcoming over 200 residents to their new home is going to be our primary goal. This can only be accomplished by recruiting a high-quality team of associates who share our passion and values. Biggest worry? I really want our children and our children's children to have a great country to call home. Biggest pet peeve? People who drive slow in the fast lane. Triangle area business person you most admire. Bob Hatley, President and CEO of Paragon Bank. Education, bachelor's degree in healthcare management, Appalachian State University. Master's degree in public administration, North Carolina State University. Personal, wife Robin, two sons, Stephen and Carson. Last book you've read, Presence by Amy Cuddy. And now we turn to the Washington Watch, written by Kent Hoover. The headline, Vapor Stopper. Vaping Association claims new FDA rules will paralyze small business. Federal regulation of electronic cigarettes could vaporize small businesses and enable giant tobacco companies to dominate this new industry. So contends the American Vaping Association in response to a final U.S. Food and Drug Administration rule issued May 5 that extends its authority to all tobacco products, including e-cigarettes, cigars, and hookah and pipe tobacco. Besides banning the sale of these products to people under the age of 18, the rule will require e-cigarette manufacturers to submit their products for FDA review unless the product was on the market in 2007. The agency will evaluate the product's ingredients, design, and health risks before approving their sale. Manufacturers can continue selling their products for up to 2 years while they submit their applications to the FDA, according to the agency. But the American Vaping Association, which represents small and medium-sized businesses in the vaping and e-cigarette industry, said the FDA's rule amounts to prohibition of products that are recognized worldwide as far less hazardous than cigarettes. It likely will cost an e-cigarette company several million dollars to go through the FDA approval process, said Gregory Conley, the association's president. This gigantic price tag is affordable to big tobacco companies, but small and medium-sized businesses will be crushed, he said. The Smoke-Free Alternative Trade Association expressed similar concerns. These new regulations create an enormously cost-prohibitive regulatory process for manufacturers to market their products to adult smokers and vapers, said Cynthia Cabrera, the trade group's executive director. It also limits access to the 40 million adult smokers in the U.S. yet to make the switch to vaping and cripples a multi-billion dollar job-creating industry, the majority of which are made of small businesses, she says. Mitch Zeller, director for the FDA Center for Tobacco Products, contends the rule is reasonable and balanced, however. Regulation was necessary because young people were using e-cigarettes at alarming rates, he said. As cigarette smoking among those under 18 has fallen, the use of other nicotine products, including e-cigarettes, has taken a drastic leap, said Sylvia Burwell, Secretary of Health and Human Services. Today's announcement is an important step in the fight for a tobacco-free generation. It will help us catch up with changes in the marketplace, put into place rules that protect our kids, and give adults information they need to make informed decisions. And now we turn to the small business section for our remaining minutes to read the column written by Edward Marshall, who works with companies to build leadership cultures based on trust and collaboration. He is an adjunct professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University and managing partner of the Marshall Group, LLC. The headline on his column, Every Person at Work Wants to Matter. Everyone in the workplace knows that the bottom line matters and that without a healthy bottom line, jobs are at risk. Everyone also knows that customer satisfaction matters since without it, there is no healthy bottom line. And everyone knows that quality of products, services matters because without it, the customers won't be satisfied. And more often than not, this is where the conversation stops. There's one more step in what matters. The people want to matter. In an Ohio manufacturing company that had about 250 people working in the plant, whenever there was an economic downturn, a good 20% of that workforce was let go. It was an economic necessity, or so they were told. When the economy recovered, they started rehiring again and tried to get the same workers back. Many had already moved on or lost confidence in leadership. The company had to incur major costs of recruiting and training new workers, costs that went straight to the bottom line. The company then adopted a culture of collaboration. The workforce was organized into teams, a new governance process was put in place, and high trust was built. When the next downturn came and management wanted a 20% reduction, the workforce chose to take a week of unpaid leave instead, preserving the jobs of 50 of their fellow workers. When the economy came back, the company had saved the costs of recruiting and training and maintained loyalty and confidence. Productivity improved along with quality and profitability went up and the workforce got to share in some of those profits. The workforce found out that they mattered to each other, to leadership, and to the customers. What we know about people at work is that at the end of the day, they want to matter, to feel significant. They want to be respected, heard, honored, and supported. They want to win, learn, grow, and do their best. What we need are cultures that recognize this principle and lead accordingly. Here are some key dimensions of such a culture. Trust. Build a workplace based on trust, not fear, where people can speak their truth to power respectfully and not fear retribution. Ownership. People take care of what they own. They don't wash rented cars. Give them ownership of their jobs, the culture, vision, mission, and strategy. Listening. People know they matter if leadership listens to them and then acts on what they have learned. Learning. Create a learning environment where mistakes are opportunities to improve and grow. Acknowledgement. Honor not just the job well done, but who the people are as human beings. Develop them, nurture them, coach them. By creating a leadership culture where people feel they matter, everything else the business needs to do will happen. Productivity, quality, customer satisfaction, and profitability. And as we finish up, we'll read as much as we can of this last article. Aurobindo Pharma picks Durham site for operations, written by Amanda Hoyle. If you're a small business and you're constantly on the lookout for new leads, some additional details on a company that in April promised 275 jobs. A former manufacturing plant in Durham used by Teleflex Medical for the production of medical devices has been sold to Aurobindo Pharma USA Incorporated, an India-based pharmaceutical firm, for $2.9 million. Teleflex has sold the 32-acre property on Weck Drive near Research Triangle Park in Durham to an affiliate of Aurobindo, according to a new deed record filed in Durham County. Aurobindo had announced in April plans to establish its new headquarters for R&D in Durham with a $31.7 million capital investment in the region. The $2.9 million that Aurobindo Pharma paid for the 142,400-square-foot building and land was also at a 60% discount to the property's $7.3 million tax value. And we're going to go ahead and stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.